Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Michaela Koza. I'll be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Sounds so much stronger.
The purpose of, we got a lot of, hold on a sec, we got a lot of background. Let me put.
Yes, sir.
Sorry about that technical difficulty. So we're ready to get started. Welcome to the Awaken Call. The purpose of these calls is really to share stories and to tell stories, stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest is none other than Tu Nguyen, and someone who really embodies today's theme of resourcefulness, resilience, and the art of living. Thanks again for joining today's call. Let's start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves.
Thank you.
Thanks again for joining today's call. Our call today, we're in conversation with Tu Nguyen, and here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Preeta Bansal, will engage in a deep dialogue with Tu Nguyen, and by the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A and a circle of sharing, where we invite all your reflections and questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email us at ask@servicebase.org. That's ask@servicebase.org, A-S-K. This week's theme, as I shared earlier, is resourcefulness, resilience, and the art of living. And I was really struck when I read over the invitation to this call with a quote that Tu put up that she said when she was realized that she needed to change, the right people appeared. And I thought that was really interesting because when I think of like resourcefulness and resilience and living, it's often, my resourcefulness or my resilience or, you know, like a kind of like personal will kind of thing. And Tu kind of shifted that and she said, you know, the right people appeared and it became more of this like we are all family type of thing where resourcefulness, resilience, and living comes out of being in community, and I thought that was beautiful. Since we have the pleasure of a remarkable moderator, Preeta, today, I thought we could start by asking her to kick off our circle. And to give you some context, Preeta not only is the rock star volunteer for Awaken Calls, but she's also very similar to Tu. She's done some huge life changes and shifted careers and pursued her heart and given up very prestigious positions. And I was wondering, Preeta, that did you find that same condition apply to you where the right people appeared when you were making these huge changes that a lot of people would think, you know, that's kind of crazy to change like that?
Yeah. No, thanks, Kozo, and thanks for your great reflection at the start about how so much of resourcefulness and resilience can be in community, and it's not just kind of a single individual will kind of thing. It's funny because for me, and I think for a lot of people, the first right person to appear is often yourself. And I think just giving oneself the space the space between one's own stories, the story in your head and the story in your heart, and just living in that space for a while really allows kind of alternative stories to start emerging. And then, you know, as you start shifting, and it's, you know, it's a, both an inner and an outer thing. You start shifting inside, and then your world outside starts shifting, and the people around you start shifting, and then you get reinforced in the ways that, you know, your heart is telling you you want to go. So I think it's both an inside, it's in community, and it's within oneself, but the two are very much hand in hand. And I don't think, personally, you could, one can do the, either one of those, you know, solely alone or solely in community.
I love that, Preeta. I loved how the first person to show up is yourself. You know, the common greeting in Hawaii is aloha kako. And kako means, it means you, everybody out here, and me. It includes the speaker. Like, we don't say, how are you? We say, how are we? You know, so I love how that it's both you show up and then those right people show up. It's not either or, it's an and thing. So that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Great. So I'll let you introduce our illustrious guest.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to be in conversation this morning with Tu Nguyen, who is a remarkable woman who in a relatively short life has pretty much experienced close to everything and has really shown a lot of joy and resilience and you know, just love that shines through in everything she does. So Tu currently is the CEO and co-founder of a startup called Flozo, which is dedicated to bringing high-speed internet to smaller metropolitan cities. But, you know, that doesn't even begin to describe much of anything about Tu. Professionally, like I said, at a pretty young life, she's experienced so much. Professionally, she's had jobs at Qualcomm, IBM, Marvel Semiconductor, and TELUS. She's focused on partnerships with Facebook and connecting the world and connecting Canada to the next generation network. She's been a foodie, a blogger, a traveler, and a published author. But more remarkably, personally, she's been a refugee, an immigrant, a child of a single parent who's had to forge a relationship with a father she never knew. She's an abuse survivor. She has overcome diabetes and pre-cancer diagnoses. She's been a gang member as a teen. She's dealt with issues of race and gender and nationality and ethnicity and family split up and health issues and east-west divides and just amazing range of experiences in a young life. But I guess for me, above all, what really shines through is that she has remained joyful and authentic and wise, and through kind of an amazing breadth of experiences has packed in several lifetimes of learning and has been open to those learnings and open to both receiving those learnings and sharing them with others. So really excited to be in conversation with you and to hear some of those learnings from you.
Wow. Thanks for that introduction, Preeta. I'm really grateful for this opportunity. Your stories are amazing as well, Kozo. You survived cancer, and Preeta, you've done, I've been looking up to you as someone that's kind of brought this kind of like this career side with the personal side. So I'm so interested with you both.
Yeah, awesome. So maybe we should just, there's so many places we could start, but why don't we just start in the present moment? How are you feeling at this moment?
Actually, pretty good. I mean, the present moment is here, and I feel like that's a lot of part of my life. Just gotta put it right. So.
Well, that's awesome. So what's alive for you this morning? Like I said, we'll start shortly a little bit with your life story, but what's at this moment, what's alive for you?
Yeah, so I don't think I've ever talked about more of my inner journey, like services, and kind of got the opportunity to do this awaken call. So last night I was kind of trying to think about, okay, how to calm my nerves or how to even talk about this. And I found, I guess I was looking at my blog and I found this quote, and it said, grace means that all your mistakes now serve a purpose instead of serving shame. I guess I was wise some time ago, and it really helped me today to realize that I haven't been talking about my life story, maybe because it was kind of more on the, maybe not even consciously, but on the shame side. But at the same time, I after seeing all the other examples of people that share their story, I do think maybe this is a good way to turn my mistakes into inspiration or some kind of purpose.
Awesome. Yeah, well, there's a lot of inspiration in your story. So why don't we start from the beginning? Tell us a little bit about your life growing up, your early circumstances, and, you know, and maybe the initial shift to at least, you know, to this world of, you know, the start of achievement, let's say, in terms of engineering.
Okay. I was born in Vietnam. A few months before I was born, my father had already escaped the country with a few of my uncles in the same year. So I was born in November 1981. And then my uncle came to Canada and then was able to sponsor us over when I was about 4 years old. So we were living in a Toronto ghetto neighborhood called Regent Park, with a lot of co-op housing, a lot of immigrants, pretty rough neighborhood. And we were, I think, 13 of us in a three-bedroom house, everyone sharing a room. Like, I shared a room with my mom. And, it was a pretty rough neighborhood. One story I remember is kind of, I think, when I was in grade four, I was on the swings in the playground, and then an older girl was there and pushed me off the swing. And then I had a group of Vietnamese friends that came up and kind of, scared her away. And after that, I guess, lo and behold, I was a member of a Vietnamese gang in grade four. I think my family was pretty worried. So, by the time I was in grade six, we moved out of that area, and all my uncles, everyone worked together, and I rarely saw any of them because they were all taking different kinds of shifts work. So it was good. I moved to what in Toronto, another Toronto suburb called Scarborough, which is also not the best neighborhood, but also much better than the gang life downtown. So when I was in the suburbs, like, I think I excelled at school, and kind of that part was never a problem. It's mostly, yeah, so I guess that's the beginning.
Awesome. And what you talked, you know, it's interesting when you talk about the girls from the gang showing up and helping you when you were pushed off the swing. I mean, there was an example already of people showing up, the right people showing up at the right time in your life.
The right and wrong people, probably. yeah. I mean, in that period. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, please.
Oh. Yeah, in that period, I mean, with that gang, we started going to the local dollar store and stealing toys and things like that. So both me and my brother probably having this kind of influence around got us in trouble a lot. I guess that's my humble beginning.
Uh-huh. And what was, when you came over, your family came as refugees, what were some of the, as a child, were you struggling to kind of fit in Canada and Canadian culture? Were you, what was your mindset? Were you hanging on to your family life and, your
Yeah. Yeah, so I think
I wasn't very close to my family, I would say my whole childhood or maybe even adulthood, where I found a lot of more companionship with friends around. So I remember that first day in kindergarten, I still remember crying a lot because I didn't understand a word. I didn't know any English, and I was put into ESL class and things like that. So it was, I think, yeah, my family was pretty busy making ends meet, and mostly I was more sad I wasn't able to participate in, like, pizza days at school or skating and things like that. Anything that required any money, we just weren't able to afford. So the fitting in was more about the things that we could do without money.
Mm-hmm. So from this kind of this upbringing, how did it even come into your mind to go to college, to become an engineer, which is, not necessarily the first thing on a lot of people's minds when you're just kind of, trying to get by day to day. What? Tell us a little bit about that thought process.
So I was thinking I never really fit in. Like, my parents and my extended family was all about, like, a woman should, grow up and find a husband and serve them. And that wasn't really the life I ever wanted. And then at school, it was more of like, there must be something better. So it was actually probably more in, so I was really lucky in all the way to high school. I think I did well in school. And so in grade 10, I got a job from one of my computer science teachers at school was saying, hey, go to this company and help them pack CDs. And at that company, I basically did part-time and every summer there from CD packing, CDs that showed students how to, like, showed students university tours and things like that. This was before the internet. and basically, I got really inspired to kind of go from CD packer to software tester to web developer during the time I was in high school. So again, back to that theme of people showing up, it was the boss there, Chris Wilkins, that really kind of pushed me to go to school and pushed me to apply to Waterloo when I thought, hey, it might be too expensive, maybe I can't afford it. So yeah, I think it's been really, I feel very lucky that I just had the right push at the right time, even though maybe at that time I didn't know how to get there or what I would do. There's been really amazing people that have showed up, and he's likely the one that got me to go to Waterloo.
That's awesome. And this might be a hard question to answer, but have you ever reflected upon, like, what qualities might have made you open to receiving the right people at the right time? Like, what, let's say this, the example of this particular person who encouraged you to go to college and get these jobs. What do you think about you kind of both attracted him to you as a mentor and made you open to it?
Yeah, actually, I think someone else told me this a while ago. It's like, maybe it's like, I'm just really curious all the time. And it's maybe, like, on the negative side, it could be, like, low self-esteem, where I'm like, oh, I don't know anything very, like, I'm not the best at anything, and I don't know anything very well. So I'm always open, especially, like, I think throughout life I've always had this, like, mentality of, like, hey, each of us can only live one life, but if you listen, you can actually really experience thousands of other lives if you just listen to other people.
Wow, that's beautiful. So you go off to college, to University of Waterloo, which is a very prestigious engineering school in Canada. Tell us a little bit about your time in university and and your transition to kind of being a systems engineer at some of the world's largest and most prestigious corporations.
Yeah, so I had always wanted to leave, like, Toronto and the family and all of that. So I kind of be this rebel of going to computer engineering where there were no women. So I was really excited. When I got there, it was almost my first taste of freedom. So good or bad, I mean, young and foolish. So I just like lived it up, like I lived every second of it. So I all my work terms, I tried to go away, and it was my first time away. Like I did one work term in Vietnam and two in San Diego, and I did an exchange term in Singapore. So this university was actually probably the first time I had like the means to explore the world, and it was my first time. So I think that's when I started writing and blogging or like taking pictures. It was so new to me, and I loved it. Waterloo itself, I think it was amazing. Like I think a lot of my close friends came from there, and again, it's just being open, I think, during it. And actually, it was a good reminder that being with all the best, like I'm just one person, and there's so many other smart people there. So it kind of brought up the competitiveness and kind of like this drive to learn and be better.
Yeah, that's great. And how was you grew up with your uncles and your mother, and that you didn't really know your father, I gather, as a child, because he left before you were born. How did they respond to your life in college, as a college student, as a successful college student, as someone traveling the world?
Yeah. I think my relationship with my family has always been a little tough, in that there was a mold for me to follow on every side. Like my family grew up Catholic, and I really didn't believe in it at all. So in university, I think it was a stage where I was an atheist and a hedonist. And needless to say, I think my family was really worried traveling or drinking or eating lots and kind of just not having any ground. And I think at that stage it was more about like doing what's the opposite of them and not so much like what's growing up. So I didn't really keep in touch with them while I was at school. And it's been kind of a relationship that I think innately during even like since I was a teenager and growing up, like it was I always wanted to get away with them. And it was only until later, it was only till, you know, cancer and diabetes and kind of liver flapping back that I realized that there was like abuse that happened in my childhood. And that kind of, like, I guess I blocked it out for many, many years, and I didn't realize that my innate, like, I just had this kind of, like, thing that I would just want to get away from them, but I never really knew why. So yeah.
Well, so you, when you were in college, you said you traveled the world and you made your first trip back to Vietnam. What was that? What was that like for you? Did you connect with any family members while you're there, or just the culture?
Yeah. You mentioned my dad. He left before I was born. He came back a few times, made an appearance in Toronto a few times just to say hi and kind of ask if I wanted to move to Australia or move to Vietnam. And I never did. So when I was in college, it was during the dot-com bust. So it was actually pretty tough to get a job that around 2000, 2001. So I actually reached out to him and said, hey, can I do something for you? Can I make your website? So that was kind of the first time we got to live in the same country or city for 4 months. And it was definitely the first time, I mean, I had ever left the country. So mm-hmm. when I was there, it was a lot, a lot for someone young, I think. Like he gave me my own place, and I had like a driver, and I had a bodyguard, and I had like a security guard, and someone folded all my clothes, and it was a kid in a candy store at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing to kind of be in this culture with like amazing food and the kinds of people that was there. So during the time, I mean, I think I lived it up, but also it was pretty much just a shock for my dad and his family as well, is like, wow, this person is not grounded. So that was probably the first time out of like a series of interactions or with me and my dad that I guess for better or worse we saw sides of each other that we never saw before. So I mean, looking back, I think it was a good thing because I got to go to Vietnam and at least start that relationship. And at that time, I mean, I got to meet his new wife and his daughter, which is my stepsister. So I'm glad that happened.
Mm-hmm. And when you say you're not grounded, or that was, you said that earlier also with respect to your family, what do you mean by that? Not what they meant, but what do you
mean?
Yeah. Did you feel grounded?
So I think, no, I definitely, I think growing up and kind of, I was always trying to run away from something and be the opposite of things of say my family, and I think that took me off the ground. And then you know, school and this whole like being able to make money and flying places, I feel like for a long time I was off the ground, and yeah, so I think like by me now, if I look at that and look at where I am now, I am kind of more, a lot more on the ground, as in like I have values and I have responsibilities and things like that. And I think when I was younger, I didn't have those things.
So when did that start shifting for you? Like when do you feel like you started getting that sense of values and purpose and grounding?
Yeah, so I think university, it really launched me up there. I had a job down here in California in 2006 at Marvell, and it even launched me further up, which is in lots of flights, meeting all these CEOs around the world, doing really cool high-tech stuff, putting chips into the first iPhone and BlackBerry and Samsung and all these things. And it was almost like the brink of not being grounded, and I got really sick. So while I was there, there was three incidents. One year I went snowboarding in Tokyo with some coworkers, and then my contact exploded in my eye, and then I couldn't see for months. So that was the first time that in a series of like three accidents that kind of made me realize that I wasn't invincible. That one was, you know, when you take away something like your vision, you realize how important your eyes are. The year after that, I got into another snowboarding accident and broke my tailbone. So again, maybe parts of your body, I guess I learned lots about my body from getting into this thing and realizing, you know, I am not invincible and I am vulnerable, and that these body parts and me need to slow down. And then the third year I was there was when I went to the hospital, and I was bleeding out of control. And they said if I didn't get there on time, and a friend of mine actually drove me there, and it was just perfect timing again, like that someone came and brought me there before I would have died. So that was the biggest incident, which was like, hey, too, like, you know, you're still human, you're still fragile, slow down. So I think that was an eye-opener. That was 2009, which forced me to the ground.
Yeah, wow. That's a pretty dramatic incident where you said you were bleeding inside, almost bled to death internally. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, unlike the snowboarding incident or the kind of contact in your eye, I mean, you know, that's something presumably that didn't just come out of, I mean, it wasn't just a sudden external thing that might have caused it. There was, you know, I don't know. It seems like that's something, if you're bleeding inside, that's something that might have been going on for a while. Did you feel, I guess until you showed up in the hospital room, did you feel kind of out of whack internally?
Yeah, for years I would say I was out of whack. Like I was flying on private jets. I was like drinking a lot. I was eating in all these fancy restaurants. And I really had no, I was out and about so much that I never was home. I was never sleeping. And it's just, I felt terrible. But at the same time, this whole, like, I don't know, like, living the dream or whatever dream that was, that felt a lot more important than taking care of myself. So so definitely there was a lot of signs that could have been seen beforehand.
Wow. So then, okay. So then what happens after this first big health scare? What do you make any shifts in your life, or what starts happening?
Yeah, so from the medical side, I had a hormone imbalance, and I also had pre-diabetes. So on one side, I had an endocrinologist, and they helped me kind of focus on losing weight and eating better. And so at that time, I actually didn't really know how to cook because I ate out so much. And then I started cooking, and my friend, who now happens to be my co-founder, Chris, he asked if I wanted to share with his CSA, like his vegetable delivery. And I remember that first box of vegetables that came, I really didn't know what anything in it was. And then I had to go on Google and look at pictures and kind of figure out, what is this thing? Oh, this is a squasher. what I did was, like, that was probably the first time I learned how to cook. And then, since I was still traveling for work and stuff like that, I still ate out. But then I started asking the chefs at those restaurants, say, hey, like, what do you do with this? I got this thing called kale or chard. Like, what would you do with that? So then I started blogging about it and started just like sharing recipes, probably for myself, so I didn't remember what to do. So yeah, after that, I actually ironically enjoyed the Bay Area a lot more than the 3 years before that, where I started going hiking. We did Yosemite. I went over to Machu Picchu to hike. I got this, I guess I got more work-life balance because I started prioritizing hiking and cooking, as well as work, where it was 100% of my life before. It probably went down to just more balance. So 6 months after that, I just couldn't do it anymore. It just wasn't important to me, this work side, especially because, you know, if I'm not going to live very long, I think that was the first time I got to that reality of, like, wow, like, you know, you've got to change, or this life, this single life, it might be over very soon. So I left California, and I went to Vancouver and started a cooking blog called You Cook. Just more of the same of, like, asking restaurant and chefs, you know, how to cook, and then writing about it. So that was awesome. The start of, I guess, life after corporate life.
That's what's interesting to me about that is that you have this health scare, and so you have, you know, you're told you should cook your own food, and you learn, you know, partly medicine and health reasons inspire you to that, but obviously to get to the point where you're blogging about it, you're asking chefs their recipes, you go to Vancouver to learn kind of full-time how to cook. I mean, there must have been some joy in the cooking that came about, so it wasn't just about being healthy. And I wonder if you can describe a little bit about, like, how you felt when you first started learning how to cook.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, blogging about it was really nice because a lot of my friends that maybe I haven't even seen in a while from Toronto and Waterloo started, like, participating and sending me recipes, and it was a nice, like, I guess, push for, hey, this is a good thing, like, keep doing it. And then when I went to Vancouver, it was just, like, maybe random luck. It happened to be around the Vancouver Olympics, and while I was interviewing chefs, I was like, oh, hey, maybe I can reach out to all the countries that will be here at that time. So every country is represented, and they all want to feature their food and culture. So somehow I happened to, like, become Vancouver, like, official media for the Olympics, and I got invited to all these houses, like Germany, Switzerland, Italy, and eat their food for free, and just all I had to do was write about them. So I mean, it was just fun, like, just kind of getting away from the tech world for a while and just, you know, live in this. And I remember our website would get like thousands and tens of thousands of views. And I never.
This is your blog. This is your blogging site. Sorry.
YouCook.ca, which is not there right now. But I think it was. I just happened upon it, and I think it was good for me to kind of take a break from tech.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so how long of a break was this kind of cooking immersion?
Ted, that was my first startup. I was like, oh, this blog is going to lead to an app, because at that time the iPad had just come out. And I was like, okay, if we could do what iTunes did to music, which is people could buy like a recipe for $1, I could go to chefs and kind of try to create that kind of content. At that time, I mean, I knew nothing. I mean, corporate life and startup life is so different that I think that was my first, like, dip into, oh, wow, startup life is not the same. and you really don't know what the future is, and it's just one step at a time and kind of dealing with all that uncertainty, where in a corporate job, you have goals and you can just meet those goals. So it was my first and really terrible attempt at turning free food into a sustainable life. So it was about two years, I guess. I went to Vancouver, ran out of money, and went to Toronto. I tried to do a little bit of consulting work, and then I kind of got to the, okay, I think my break is over, because I'm going to run out of money, and I guess I should just go get a job again. But I wanted to do one last hurrah, I guess. And so I started a Kickstarter project, and that was the first year Kickstarter was around. And I was like, okay, what if people could sponsor me and I could go to Vietnam? Because out of the Vancouver Olympic experience, I realized that I learned how to cook all this other food, but I never really learned how to cook my own, which is like Vietnamese cooking. So I actually thought of an idea where I would go through Vietnam and learn how to make the best banh mi, which is like the Vietnamese sandwich. And this would be my last, like, 3 months, like, last thing I would do before I would go back to tech. So that's what I did. I put up the project. I went to Vietnam. And during the travels, I wouldn't know if, you know, I'd get enough funding to kind of write the book and publish it. So I timed it so that when I got to Ho Chi Minh City, where my dad and my sister lived, that I would know if I got funding. And then if I did, then I would write the book and publish it. So I did that.
That's awesome. And how was it during this whole time that you were kind of, it started off as a hobby to learn to cook, then, you know, I guess your resourcefulness and resilience turned it into a potential startup and then a Kickstarter campaign. How was your health during all this? Did cooking remain joyful and free, or did it become a bit of a job?
Yeah, so that's the funny thing. I think cooking personally is a lot of fun. And I mean, even years later, I tried to make a Vietnamese sandwich startup for a blip of time, maybe a month. But in all those experiences, I realized when cooking for money or cooking for business or any of that, kind of, I think it's the money part that kind of takes you off the ground, or takes me off the ground again, which is, you know, cooking to make a living is not the same as cooking for your friends, the kind of joy that brings. So that's, I guess that's the second time I got off the ground, and then again, a rude awakening of realizing that, hey, stay grounded. So cook for health, but not for business.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you run out of money and you go back into the tech world. This is kind of so then what happens then?
So I came back to Canada after the Vietnam experience. I published my book there. I used the wrong publisher, so then the books I couldn't leave Vietnam. So that ended up being my first like startup that made money. Because those books actually, I think I sold a few thousand of those books throughout the country. But when I left, I was really sad because I couldn't export them. So So I kind of left that stage as, oh man, that's another startup fail number two. I came back and I joined, I guess I was looking for a job, but then somehow I ended up working with a friend of mine in helping his startup. So he went, they were doing mobile apps for big Canadian retailers. And then also he asked me to come on to kind of help with like Wi-Fi and location-based couponing and all these things. So totally up my alley, and I did that for a bit. And still it was a startup world, so it was a lot of sacrifice and kind of not meeting making ends meet. So after a year of that, I guess I was still reeling from the failure, I guess in quotes, failure of the book thing and the working with my friends thing. So at this time, I think like I was off the ground again, and this was around my 30th birthday when I was like, oh, I'm really, really sick now. Like, and now we're not talking about just pre-diabetes and some hormone imbalance. Now we're talking about cancer and pre-cancer, actually.
Wow. Yeah, so how did you get that? How did that manifest? How did you get that diagnosis?
So again, the bleeding thing, I was having like months of no period, and then I would have, I think from July to September, or no, July to November, I was constantly, my period never stopped. So I was really worried. I didn't know what to do. And then again, the randomness of people appearing, two of my friends appeared, and one of them happened to just come back from Thailand and Pakistan, and she happened to be a naturopath. And messaged me saying, hey, I really enjoyed your book because I just went to Vietnam with my family, and you know, I used your book to go through the country. I was like, oh, okay, let's meet up. So when I met up with her, we talked. I told her what was going on with me, and I'm like, oh, do you think you could solve this bleeding problem of mine? And then she was like, that's really serious. So she actually helped me walk through the Western medical system with all the tests, like the sugar test, like the, and then trying to get to gynecologists and stuff like that to see, like, to get just the real accurate, like, description and diagnosis of what was going on. So the first thing we did was try to, so the Western medicine guys tried to get me to take a bunch of drugs to stop the bleeding. And I actually went with her recommendation of some homeopath and tinctures to stop the bleeding. So within, I think, 2 weeks, the bleeding stopped, and so that we could do some of the tests, like biopsies. So it was pretty major. I think I was going to bleed to death again, and she stopped it. She helped with me to stop that. We did the tests, and then that's when the diagnosis came up of, like, hey, this is called complex atypia hyperplasia, and it's really the stage right before it spreads all over. So that was a shock to me. And around all of this, I had just gotten a job in a big company again. So a lot of things were happening at once. And it was good. I mean, my manager at my big company job, who now is my co-founder, Andrew, really gave me all the support I needed to kind of take it easy and like worry about my health first.
Wow, that's amazing. And when you got such a serious diagnosis for the second, during the second health scare, just curious, like, what drew you to kind of non-Western modalities of treating that? A lot of people, you know, might be too scared by the kind of traditional model to go that route.
Yeah, so I think it was a lot of trust. So my naturopath friend, like, I went to school with her at Waterloo, and I mean, she's an intelligent person that could have gone to become a Western medical doctor or took the naturopath route. And I think what drew me to her was just her presence and her friendship of not just like, I mean, sometimes you talk about Eastern stuff and there's a lot of things about beliefs and things like that, maybe no evidence, but what everything that we talked about and everything that she showed me, there was always some kind of proof and some kind of something that's worked for other people before. So it wasn't, I really enjoyed the company and just having someone that was grounded to guide me and talk about all the diet, all the things, like all the blood work, all of those things, and help me like understand, you know, these are all my options. So it wasn't, I liked it because I wasn't in fear. And yeah. I think a lot of times, and when I look back, like I think any time that you don't know that you're vulnerable and you're gonna be sick and you get this diagnosis from a doctor, there's a lot of fear, there's PTSD, there's all this thing of like, oh wow, I'm really scared. And then they usually follow on that with like, all right, let's schedule you to operate next week and let's cut out some body parts. And so that's happened with my doctor, which told me that I need a hysterectomy the next week and said, oh yeah, that's the only way, this like, if you don't have anything there, then you can't get cancer there, which I never really, really bought into, which is, well, my belief is more about, you know, if you don't know what that root cause is and you just start cutting stuff off, the root cause is kind of like mold. I mean, you can get sick from mold, but if you don't get rid of where the mold is coming from, it's going to come back. And you're still going to get all these symptoms. And what, are you going to cut out your lung next? Are you going to cut out like other parts? So I really just thought, hey, let me just understand. Like, this is not a new thing. Like, I have been sick before. And this is going to come back if I don't really understand what was causing it and how I can fix it at a fundamental level. And also I thought, hey, it's pre-cancer, not cancer. So maybe, and I'm young and maybe naive, but I was like, oh, maybe I let me try this, because a year of this or 2 years of this, what's the harm? I'll have to cut it out anyway. So I felt like I had a little bit of time to just explore.
Wow, that's very wise. And, you know, in an abbreviated conversation like this, we kind of, you know, it kind of sounds like, oh, and then I did naturopathy and then I was kind of cured. But I'm sure it's just a much more longer, involved process. And, you know, I don't want to kind of diminish that journey. So if you want to share anything about, you know, any of the struggles or doubts or fears you had along that, please do.
Yeah, I think, again, I think it goes back to my curiosity. I was just very curious because in my life, I mean, actually my brother's a Western doctor and so is his wife. And I had gone through the medical system like down here in California before. And it was just very cut and dry. Like, okay, this is what you have and this is what you do. But it was like, you have to go see the specialist for this one body part and this one thing for this other body part. And there was no like holistic one. And so I think meeting Lily and then my naturopath was just very interesting, because we were, when we talked, it wasn't just about one part and it wasn't just about like the symptoms. It was actually about like, you know, working through with her for years, it was actually about, hey, like digging up the past or like what, kind of like observing what's going on, like what is reality, what's going on in all aspects of my life, friendship and work. And I had never done that before. So it was more curiosity, like, okay, like I see the other side, which is like treating symptoms. And I see this, which is like more of a life change. And I feel like I'm good at those short spurts, but I just never had the guidance of this like more like shift, which is more holistic.
That's awesome. So what were some of the treatments and some of the modalities that she and others introduced you to in this time that you think helped you?
So it was gradual. Like the first one was, you know, stop the bleeding. So it was a very like focused thing. And then when it came to a place of, okay, like lifestyle, like actually one of the things she asked me early on is, what do you think you need to change? Which is new. I've never been to a doctor that asked me if I knew the answer. So we wrote down some of those things. And then it's like, okay, how do you get balance? How do you repair some relationships in your life? There were so many, but the biggest thing I would say, like, as I'm trying to pick which one, but one of the most lasting one, like, advice she gave me was to go to Vipassana, which is the 10-day silent retreat. I really trusted her recommendations because she experimented on herself. So she went first and then she came out and told me, hey, this will be really good for you. So I, you know, at that time I was like, 10 days of silence. No, thank you. Like, how do you do that when you have 2 weeks of vacation? This is no way. Are you going to spend your whole vacation like sitting in silence? I wasn't really into it for a while. And then 6 months after, it kept on coming back. I was like, okay, if this really helps, like, why not, right? 10 days maybe to help, like, a whole lifetime is not that long. So I think that was one thing that she helped me, introduce me to, which has become, like, a daily practice.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So what was your experience at your first 10-day Vipassana?
I went to the one north of Toronto, and it was kind of around the transition between winter and spring. And so when I went there, it was snow covered everywhere. And inside Vipassana, you learn things like every moment will pass, like this too will pass. And it was just really interesting because you could hear that, but you could also see it there because every day, you know, the snow turned into rain, into sun, and back to rain, and it was just so different every single day. I think it was really hard. I've never sat that long before, and it was almost it was hard, but it was really nice. I really enjoyed the little breaks so that you get to walk around in the trees and just see it for yourself on the outside. But during that time, I think the big realization I had, because during the one danger about blogging and telling your story is you kind of get into this, like, you're a victim and all these things keep happening to you. And I think I was kind of in that mentality. And so when I went there and I looked around, and especially that last day when people start talking, they tell you all their life stories and you feel like you're so close, I realized that so many other people are suffering as well. And a lot of these stories are way worse than me. And I look back and I'm so lucky. So looking at that actually helped me get out of myself or get over myself, which is like, hey, stuff happened to you, but you're still here and you're healthy and you have, you know, good friends and like abilities to do a lot of things. So like, don't keep feeling sorry for yourself. Like, everyone else has it worse and everyone is suffering. So I think that very first retreat, that's the thing I kind of came up with is everyone, that quote of like, everyone's living a hard life. You never know, so just to treat everyone with kindness.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful.
Sounds like the birth of compassion there too. That's beautiful.
Thanks, Koza.
Yeah, so we're reaching the top of the hour, and I want to open up the circle of sharing and questions for people. The lines are open. You can press *6 on your phone, and you'll be put into the queue and told prompted when to speak. Or you can also email us at ask@servicespace.com. So, .org. Erase that. So ask@servicespace.org. And so we'll start Q&A after. I think Prita, maybe one more question and then we'll start sharing.
Sure.
Thanks. Okay, so there's, gosh, I could keep talking to you forever, but let's circle back to kind of, you know, you're going through these amazing changes in your life, relearning the art of living, you know, doing some profound healing at a deep level. It starts, from what I gather, starting to have physical effects where, you know, your health has improved. What's going on professionally at this time? So you were, I know you were working at a big corporation, and now you're starting up, now you're doing this other startup, Flozo. And I want to kind of bring this back to your own, you know, mission of connecting the world and kind of, you know, where that is in all this, where you came, you know, how that inspired you and, you know.
Yeah. So I think this whole journey, this, like, I throughout it, it's almost this global thing I went through. It's multiple countries, multiple people, and lots of different books and kind of inspiration I got throughout the time. And I think one thread, and I had applied to, when I applied to Waterloo, my application said, I want to come here because I want to come to Silicon Valley and connect the world. And I look back, and I think the whole, like, the blogging as a healing mechanism, the Kickstarter, like, all of these things that I've done is not possible without resources like Service Space, Awaken, and being there, you know, being connected to all this content. And so I think that there's a lot of people, including myself, that really needed that connection. And I couldn't find that connection just through, say, my family and where I grew up. And I have found this kind of global connection. So throughout my career, it has been this telecom and kind of connecting through communication and social. And I started Flozo really as this way that I could bring this connection to more people so that they can help themselves. So actually, I don't know, I guess I'm not even American, but when I saw the election results in November and in CNN, they had the map that zoomed into all of these small towns and all over the US. It was almost the same map that we had in our company of like all the cities that only have one choice in connectivity or none. And I realized, like, hey, this is really underserved, and maybe these people are struggling, maybe on the economic side, that they can't get jobs, and they're not participating in this amazing like online economy of, you know, TaskRabbit or all kinds of things that you can have online and learning and even participating and being creative. And I was thinking, like, hey, Flozo could do something good, which is enable neighborhoods to help each other and get connected so that they too can have startups, or they too can help themselves. So I see kind of Flozo and this whole experiment here, like being here and living this part of my life is, I guess I've been so lucky to kind of get all the opportunities I have. Like, how do I take what I've learned both from the technical and life experience side and really help others and enable others to help themselves and each other. That's where Flozo, I guess, comes from.
Interesting. And before we, I just want to have one quick follow-up to that. It's interesting, you know, when go back to the theme of this call about the right people showing up and your interest in connecting the world, it's just interesting that it seems like in your life it's been a combination of very deep ties and loose ties that have kind of come to your aid or have found you at the right time. So I just, your friend that's the naturopath, you know, that was, you said, a friendship from college. How did you reconnect after all those years? It was partly through your book, I gather. She said she'd used it as she was traveling to Vietnam. But how did she reach you? Like, did you stay in touch all those years, or was that partly through the beauty of social media and the internet that she reconnected with you?
It's the beauty of the internet and my Facebook, I think. And I think it comes back over and over again, which is, I mean, I have been in different places and probably not reachable many times. And so I do feel, even today with the startup I have, it's just full of old connections. Like, my friend who I worked with at Marvell is my co-founder now, who helped me with the whole learning what a vegetable is. And then Andrew is my manager at my old company, and the support he gave to me then, now he's my operations guy. And it's just everything, like being in Alchemist, the accelerator program, and all the people I've met along the way. An old friend, Ming, now is an investor in our startup. And I don't know, somehow I think the stage right now, there's just lots of people that are coming back into my life, or maybe like there were loose ties and now have become very close friends. So I think this, none of this would be possible without the internet.
Beautiful. I'm going to jump in front of the line and get a question in here, because obviously a lot of your story resonates with me. And you said something, you said something that really piqued my interest. You said that it wasn't until you had the pre-cancer and diabetes diagnosis that you kind of uncovered that abuse that happened in your past, you know. And and I've found that healing, when we go into a healing crisis or a healing journey, it's not just about healing the body, but it's about healing past wounds, past traumas, ancestral trauma, different things. And yeah. I'm wondering if you had that same experience, and that when you were doing all this, naturopath and healing work, if you felt like you were also healing that trauma in the past.
Yeah, I think during that process, it was actually an uncle of mine that I guess I blocked it out, but I became, he was probably my closest link to family, because he had gone to Waterloo as well. So when I had moved back, and I had left for a long time, so maybe I started it really deep. But as I was working through kind of healing, I was still in touch with him. So he was actually, he was visiting us, in my condo, and suddenly I saw these images and flashes of what he did to me as a child, and I just broke down and cried. Because I didn't know if it was a dream or it was real. My naturopath said, maybe the universe doesn't give you things until you can handle it. So until I could, get rid of all the other things that was going on, kind of like healing and stopping the bleeding and kind of getting back into balance was when this showed up. So it's almost, and I think it happens in Vipassana as well. When you're still enough and things arise, those things that arise somehow have this like heavier degree of kind of things you have to work through. So I think with the abuse, I wouldn't say any real specific thing kind of like came up, but it did. And it did in a way that was like really terrible. But yeah, during that process of healing that, I went through an alternative psychologist, and doing EMDR, which is something they do for PTSD patients and kind of people that come back from war, or seen people die or kill people. So that was another launch into this whole understanding what the brain is and how emotion is so tied to events and kind of how do you still acknowledge that happened, but that you're still able to live a functional life. I don't know if that answers your question, Chikozo, but I guess that was more detail on what happened there.
Yeah, and just a quick follow-up, it really reminds me of, when you say you broke down and you were crying and or in the Vipassana, just really delving deep into that pain and suffering. It reminds me of something you wrote on your blog where you said, joy and pain and joy are like yin and yang, right? That you can't have one without the other, and it is only through this deep suffering that you were able to experience deep joy. And I'm wondering if you could kind of map that out for us, for those of us who are still in the deep suffering and
I like to say, actually, like, now that I guess I've had a little bit of experience of kind of going from these bottoms to, like, bouncing back. And, I mean, during the moment, it sucks. And I would say, like, even now, like, say one part of my life is good and other parts are not as great and suffering. You know, I think now, like, I think experience helps. Like, when you get to that bottom and when you get to that ground, when you fail multiple times and you keep doing the same thing, eventually you get tired of it. And eventually you're like, okay, I want to bounce back. I want to take a walk. I want to, like, I like myself enough that, like, maybe I don't need to suffer. And I think this happens, you know, when you lose someone, when you lose your house, is in that moment, it's terrible, but at the same time, you're still alive and, you know, you can do anything you want. So kind of, and then if you remember, or maybe you could just trust me that, like, one day things will get better and whatever's happening now will pass. And I mean, even if I say it, I still get into lots of, like, oh no, the world is ending. But, you know, I think space and kind of stepping back or being able to, like, do things that can help you step back, like going hiking or cooking or hanging out with friends or just kind of getting out of yourself, is things that I feel like has helped me remember that, like, you know, if you're suffering, like the level of suffering will be matched with, like, a huge, like, a multiple of joy eventually, just maybe not right now.
And, you know, you said something in there that really stood out to me. You said, I like myself enough, you know, and I see a lot of your journey as kind of like realizing that, right? Like, when you like yourself enough to cook yourself good, healthy food, you like yourself enough to get off this rat race of just acquisition and stress. And I think that's such an important part of healing. I like myself enough. I love that term.
Cool.
So we have a question from online. And again, phone lines, if you want to call in on the phone line, hit *6 on your phone. But I'm not sure how to pronounce her name. It might be John, J-A-U-N-E, John Evans, or it might be a typo for Jane. John Evans says, hi, thanks for a wonderful interview. Could you tell us more about how she faced, quote, not being invincible, unquote? More importantly, how she manages to maintain that insight, since it's so sneaky and reasserts itself when we feel as if we have recovered, now strong and invincible again. With love and admiration and gratitude, John. So, I love that question. How do you maintain that insight of not being invincible, especially when, you know, you get a diagnosis or you get a, you know, a mission?
Yeah, so I was actually talking to another alchemist co-founder the other day named Beal, and she said something that kind of stuck with me, is that there's no such thing as perfect health, perfect state of mind, perfect, you know, like, I guess what she said was, like, there's this norm, and everyone thinks that there's this thing, and everyone had it at some point, and now we lost it, and so then the loss is so terrible. But if you kind of just go from that basis of, you know, there is no perfect state. You just have you, and your body is always fighting stuff at any time, and your mind, you know, there's not ever this, like, 100% happy state. So it's not like you're losing anything anytime. It's just that maybe in varying degrees of suffering, what you're experiencing right now isn't as ideal, and you do remember times of joy. But if you really go back to some of those times where your life was perfect, there was always something that was not that perfect about it. So, yeah, maybe that's what I would offer is trying to get back to this reality of their life is kind of something that we go through, and there's ups and downs, and there's no such thing as normal.
Yeah, and also when you do backtrack a little bit, you know, still like yourself and be gentle and forgive yourself and then keep on the journey, right?
Yeah.
We have another comment from David Doan, and he says, he's talking about the right people. The right people have appeared when I've been ready. They spoke to what I was ready to hear. They pushed my limits enough to stretch me and not so much as to lose contact with me. They spoke truth, or at least what rang true for me. They touched me intellectually and deeper, emotionally, and even spiritually. They fostered my growth. And it sounds very similar to your experience, too.
Oh, that's beautiful, David. Yeah, I guess I start noticing it, like, especially now that we do have Facebook, is that whatever you're ready for and whatever news you're attracted to kind of are the ones that you notice on your newsfeed. And that's what I would say with people around you as well, there are amazing people around you, and we have a lot more similarities than differences, and you just have to be open and more clear about, like, what is it that you're working on or need or things, and those people do appear. And I'm sure I'm not an isolated incident, but I have been very lucky to kind of notice that.
Yeah, you know, David wrote, they spoke to what I was ready to hear. And also, I think about how you said that, you know, when you were very curious, right, and maybe that stemmed out of an insecurity of just wanting to, you know, make yourself better and stuff like that. But there came, you know, too, if I look at your life, there came a certain point where you're flying around in private jets, you know, and you're snowboarding in Japan, and you know what I mean? And so, like, there's this thing that I've seen happen in my own life where we, you know, maybe we start off curious, but then we accomplish a lot, and then we become, you know, call it cocky or call it, you know, egotistical, and then we stop listening, right? We stop when people... My cousin told me at one point, he says, like, you know, when somebody tries to help, tell you something to help you, you never listen. So I'm wondering how you stayed, I guess, kept that humility, kept that curiosity, kept that humbleness to allow you to hear, even while you were highly successful, or did you know? Or is it a different story? I'm not sure, but I'm very curious about that.
That's a good question. I mean, if you ask a lot of my friends and people that have tried to help me and kind of looked at my train wreck and I repeated it, there are a lot of advice, and there was a lot of people and a lot of help I definitely didn't take. And looking back, I mean, I am trying to repair a lot of friendships and a lot of things I did while I was totally high on myself and had a huge ego and were super cocky. So I wouldn't say I've been this, like, angel throughout this process. But I think, again, it's about, at least I did something, and I, like, yeah, and you could see it, which is, oh, that's not the right thing to do. So I think it's just with practice, maybe, and remembering and kind of getting back to the ground and kind of being humble. So because of this past week at Awaken, there was this reading, and I really enjoyed it because it was about, it said something like, anything worth doing is worth doing badly, which is the things that are important, you know, love and whatever it is that's important to you, we're not going to get right the first time. even curiosity or even taking advice from other people. So I really was like, oh, okay, that makes a lot of sense. It's like, it's okay. Even connecting the world and connecting the people to the internet, there's bad ways to do it, which is like selling personal data, like just treating people like numbers and kind of being like the worst hated company in the US is the ISPs. You know, there's bad ways of doing it, and but it's still worth doing. So how do you do it less badly?
Like, you know, fail in a, and I know you said at one point you just set out to fail. You know, like, I'm gonna fail, and I'm gonna get by a step and do it again. And that seems to be that resilience and that humility seems to be the hallmark of so many people who accomplish amazing things in this world.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you wake up and you're still here and you still have access to your arms and legs and mind, you still have a chance. Like, I think, you know, when that's over, then, you know, then you can't try. Maybe you try in another life. But otherwise, I think there's always something that can still be done, and you might as well do it before you run out of chances.
Yeah.
I still have a chance.
I have just a quick follow-up, and I know there's a few other questions here in the queue online, but now that you're doing this kind of daily meditation practice, you've had these experiences with pretty amazing health scares, and you have a sense of your kind of internal being. Are you able to feel kind of somatically when, you know, even things get slightly out of balance in your life? Or is that something you're still struggling to get the tools to do? I'm asking that just out of pure personal interest, because I'm doing daily Vipassana practice too, and I'm wondering how, you know, whether it's helping you in that regard.
Yeah, so I can say that when I do miss it, like the morning sitting, or say I don't show up on Wednesday to awaken, I feel it. Like, I feel, you know, or you can ask my co-founders. But yeah, I definitely do feel kind of out of balance at those times. Maybe I'm like quicker to be confrontational or argumentative or pick at details and stuff like that. But I have seen it work wonders if I could just keep that grounding. But yeah, there's just, sometimes there's just not enough time in the day to do everything that I'm currently doing. So it's just, I guess I know how I am when I'm not balanced. and it comes up, you know, week after week, or when there's pressure and deadlines and stuff like that. So it's just, I've kind of resorted to, okay, can I do like 5 minutes? if the day doesn't really get that. And then the other thing I actually started doing with the support of like my team is inside of the workday, like on our stand-up meeting, which is like a morning kind of 10-minute meeting of checking in, we start that meeting with like a minute of silence. So just so whatever happened before, even if I meditated or not meditated, or, you know, like whatever, I could at least, and we use Insight Timer, which I use to kind of track my meditation every day. At least if I didn't meditate that day, we still did a minute. So it's like trying to, like, it's like seeing where out of balance is, and then doing like little baby steps to try to bring it back to there. But yeah, I'm no expert yet, Prita.
We have a comment that's kind of in line with that. Cynthia Chang says, thank you so much for this wonderful interview, and I enjoyed the comment about we are never perfect in our physical condition and we never lose things. This is so inspiring and is turning negative to positive. I also want to thank the three of you for being the persons delivering the messages to the audience. I learned so much from the conversation. I'm looking forward to getting the recording so I can share with other friends who are in need of the journeys, experiences, and advices shared during the interview, Cynthia Chang. And I'm just wondering, you know, to piggyback on that, do you see yourself moving into this new role of now, you know, as like the wounded healer, right? Like you went through the wound, and now do you feel yourself sharing the medicine or spreading the medicine?
Yeah, I think before I moved down here, not that I've moved down here yet, I still live in Toronto. Before this past year, I think what I was asking for, I didn't know how to do is, like, how do I serve now that I guess I've gone through a little, or I know one or two things, like, who might need my help? And so kind of coming down here and getting guided to get to the Awakened Circle, and now, and then starting to open up about these stories, I guess I didn't realize that. It was maybe from that, like, maybe it was still mistakes were still shameful rather than like, oh, it helped someone else. So it was only recently that I feel like I've been being guided, like, oh, okay, the things I'm saying is inspirational to someone else. And that's new for me. And this new role of, I guess, the wounded healer. I wouldn't call myself a healer. I'm more of I'm just the tech nerd that wants to connect the world. I'm not sure I'm at the healer stage, but I can share my story.
What's interesting to me about that, though, too, is that, you know, you talked about the shame and I think regardless of all of our experiences in life, we all have a certain amount of shame about our past. But on the other hand, you've been this blogger. You were, you know, putting out Instagram quotes about your healing journey. So at some level, it feels like you have been maybe a bit of a natural or intuitive storyteller. And you have been sharing your story in a way that, you know, I certainly have never done. It's just interesting to me.
Yeah, I think so, but I just nobody reads my story, so it's like, I think at least for the blogs and stuff like that, I do think it was more as something for myself to remember, and then just kind of instead of not having time to reach out to friends, it's like, oh, here's like what I'm doing. So it was more, I guess, natural rather than something that I intended on doing to help others.
If you had to give, this is a really unfair question because there's so many things, but if you had to, let's say you were confronted with a young woman, maybe a younger version of two, who's like maybe in her adolescence now, is there any, you know, any words of wisdom or I don't want to say advice, but are there any words of wisdom you might want to impart to somebody that is going to go through a number of ups and downs in life?
It's interesting because actually my relationship with my little stepsister, she's 12 years younger than me. And I feel like after we became friends when I lived in Vietnam, I play the role of a big sister, maybe well at times and badly at times when I try to tell her, hey, like if you do this, you're going to suffer a lot. So I think I've had a lot of practice. And what I realized was the only thing you can give is love. Hey, you know, I could point it out that like, you will go through these things, but it's okay. I'm here for you and here no matter what. So I think I have tried, and I've tried very badly when I've seen others that are about to make the mistakes I've made before, and telling them not to do it never works. So I just thought, like maybe I'll tell stories myself and what I did in those cases. I think it just comes down to like I'm here for you, and you know, do your thing, like listen to yourself, and you know, cultivate that like internal GPS or navigation. And I think skillfully, that's probably the stage I'm at now. Like, how do you help others skillfully rather than telling them what to do? So if I met a younger version of me, I'd say go for it, right? Do your thing and maybe step back and think about what reality is once in a while.
Oh, beautiful. And, you know, on that same line, too, we're here for you now. So I have one final question, and it's how can we, as the larger service based community, support your work or support, you know, your mission?
Wow. Yeah, I think, like, being part of service space, being able to come to Awaken, maybe even starting Awaken in Toronto would be all amazing things that the community could do. In terms of kind of this mission we're on to connect the world, we're in an accelerator program kind of gearing up for demo day at the end of next month. And what I'm looking for is more people in cities that, like, really hate their internet service provider and really see that this is a business that they want to start in their community and wanting to connect the world, are connecting their neighborhood. Just reach out to me and, you know, let's see how we can work together and help each other.
Beautiful. Beautiful, yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much. You know, what really resonates for me during this call is that connectivity, you know, right people showing up at the right time, connecting the world, having these relationships that really support us. And I feel so grateful to have a relationship with you, and also to be able to share space with you at the Awaken Circles. And quick plug for tomorrow night, Healing and Transformation. Circle at Teance in Berkeley. But yeah, thank you so much for just that resilience and that desire to connect, you know, to connect the world, to connect individuals, to connect and like you said, to just give love. So beautiful call. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity, and it's really fun to talk to you, Frida and Kozo. I feel like sometimes I would like to interview you too, because I think your story is a lot more experience and a lot more than mine. So I'm really grateful for this opportunity.
So we're going to invite everyone to hold a collective minute of silence and just hold that connectivity and that attitude for this beautiful call and for this beautiful circle. After the minute of silence, I'll open up the lines and we'll do gratitude out loud together. So we'll just say thank you to two in any way or whatever feels good to you. So let's do a minute of silence first. Thank you. Well, let's do a big chaotic gratitude. So say thank you in any way that feels good to you for two and for this call and for this beautiful circle. One. Two, three.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.